And tonight I'm going to talk about the topic of rebirth. The reason I want to talk about this is because very often this is like a controversial topic in Buddhism. And often people disagree on whether it's necessary to actually have confidence or believe in rebirth in Buddhism, or whether in fact it's possible to just discard rebirth and say it's not really important in the Buddha's teachings. It's not something that we need to believe in. It doesn't really matter whether there's rebirth or not. You can still be a Buddhist. And one of the things that I've often found is when I read books about Buddhism, that sometimes you come across statements like, rebirth is not actually a Buddhist belief. Rebirth is a pre-Buddhist belief, which Buddhism took on board when it emerged in ancient India. In other words, it existed. It was a cultural thing in India which already existed. And then when Buddhism came on the scene, it just took on this cultural thing which already existed in India at the time. So this is always an important question, because if rebirth is not a Buddhist belief, then there are good grounds maybe to reject it as not being so important. And then finally, I want to talk about this. Well, what have given all the evidence about rebirth? What should our attitude be towards rebirth? Should we believe in it or should we not believe in it? And how, not least, how should we believe in rebirth? So the first thing is then to understand whether rebirth, in fact, is important in Buddhism. And to get a grasp of this, I want to tell a little bit of the part of the Buddha's story himself before he was enlightened, and the Buddha's search for enlightenment, because this search in itself sheds a lot of light on the importance of rebirth in Buddhism, or whether it's not important. And as many of you already will know, the Buddha's story, I can start from his when he was still a layperson, before he even went forth, before he became an ascetic who practiced in the forest like other ascetics at the time. Everybody knows, most people know who are Buddhist, that the Buddha enjoyed a very privileged life before he became an ascetic. He had all the pleasures that people can have or had in those days 2,500 years ago. He it was only when he realized the dangers in life, the dangers of particularly of old age, death, and also sickness, and he saw the potential suffering in life, not only the potential suffering, the real suffering in life, and the kind of suffering that he also would have to go through later on, that he decided that he would give up all those pleasures that he had in great abundance compared to most people at the time. So that's how the Buddha started his life, started his kind of search, if you like, search for something beyond, something more than just ordinary sensual life of most people. The first thing the Buddha did after he left his home life was to search for teachers, search for other teachers who could tell him, show him the path towards something more than just enjoyment of sensual pleasures. And this is natural. We all, you know, want to find the easy way, and the easy way is obviously to have a teacher rather than actually discovering everything for ourselves. That's exactly what the Buddha did. And the first two teachers that the Buddha had, and this is all found in the discourses and the suttas that the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago. These two teachers, one was known as Alara Kalama, one was known as Udaka Ramaputta. And they taught a path of meditation. So he followed this path of meditation, and he gained some very powerful and deep states of meditation by following their advice. But then, when he actually gained those states, and he reflected on them, he realized that these states only lead to rebirth. They lead to rebirth in that particular realm which those states correspond to. So this is interesting, if for no other reason than to realize that certainly rebirth was a very prevalent idea at the time of the Buddha. You see that the Buddha automatically, he actually wasn't the Buddha yet at this point, he was the Bodhisattva, but he automatically thought in terms of rebirth. And he rejected this particular path precisely because it only led to rebirth. So this was not enough for him. And you realize that when you read the discourses of the Buddha, it's full of rebirth everywhere. And not talking about, for example, if you read about some of the other ascetics at the time of the Buddha, they would always talk in terms of rebirth. They would talk about purification by rebirth, or you had the Brahmins who were talking about the ideal of the Brahmins was to actually get rebirth together with Brahma in the future. So the whole Indian scene at the time was about rebirth, basically. And the Buddha obviously also thought in the same way. So this is a first pointer here, that the importance of rebirth at the time of the Buddha. But then, of course, the Buddha rejected that because he saw the danger of rebirth. It always leads to old age. It always eventually leads to death. And for that reason, it is not satisfactory. It is fraught with suffering and problems. So the Buddha then left these teachings, and he decided to go out of his own and practice what at that time was considered the most important spiritual practice, which was asceticism. So he practiced asceticism to an extreme degree, to the point where he realized that if I take this asceticism any further, I am going to die. He did things like extreme fasts, like eating a single rice grain a day, like torturing the body, like we often see even today in India, we see all this torturing of the body going on. And he took it to the point where he, if he went any further, he would die. So he realized, well, I have taken this path to its conclusion, can't go any further, so maybe I'm going the wrong way. At that point, he reflected that, well, I've tried asceticism to its extreme. I have lived the life of a householder with great pleasures, which is the other extreme. Could there be another path to enlightenment? Something which is neither sensual pleasures nor the opposite of sensual pleasures, which is the mortification of the physical body. At this stage, the Buddha realized that, yes, he recalled his experience as a young boy when he had a deep state of meditation. And he realized that, yes, this deep state of meditation I had as a boy, this is a path to enlightenment. This deep samadhi state, known otherwise as the jhanas, this is the way. It avoids sensual pleasures. It avoids sensual pain. It's known as the middle way between those two. And then, having understood this, he practiced these deep states of meditation. And when he practiced those deep states of meditation, his mind gained this incredible power, incredible bliss, which then was the causal condition for allowing him to penetrate profound truths of reality. Now, once he had attained these states of meditation, the first thing he did at that point was to ask himself, well, is this idea of rebirth, is it true? Does it actually exist? And you can see why he would ask this thing. He realized that rebirth was a big part of Indian culture at the time. And obviously he also realized that the idea of rebirth is spiritually extremely significant. Whether there is rebirth or not has incredible great bearing on spiritual practice. Because that will decide how we're going to practice, how we're going to relate to future lives, what we should do about these matters. So because of that, the first thing that the Buddha did, understanding that this was an important spiritual question, was to direct his powerful mind, this deep samadhi mind, towards recalling his past lives. So this is what the Buddha did at this stage. He started recollecting his past lives and thinking backwards, step by step, recalling who he was in his most previous life, whether he was of a particular clan, a particular family, what his name was, what kind of happiness and suffering he experienced, what kind of food he was eating. All these details of his past lives he would recall at this stage. And he would go back and back and back in time, recalling life after life after life after life. And I'm sure you can straight away see how incredibly significant this is. What this shows, of course, is that the Buddha did not just take on board a particular belief system at the time, which was present at the time in India. He discovered this for himself. And this is what we would expect. The Buddha always taught the path of inquiry, of asking questions, of finding out for ourselves what the truth is. So we would expect the Buddha also to not just take on board particular belief systems or cultural systems, but actually investigate these things for himself. And here is that discovery of the Buddha, the discovery of the reality of rebirth. So from a Buddhist point of view, this is not just a cultural thing, this is a reality. And this is what this particular thing shows. Not only is it a reality, it's an integral part of the Buddha's awakening. It's an integral part of the enlightenment experience, if you like. It's not something which is separate from that. So it's a very powerful thing. So this is the first thing to realize, that rebirth is very, very Buddhist indeed. And it's at the very heart of Buddhism. Now, after the Buddha had seen these past lives, his second question was, well, what is the causal experience, the causal connection that gives rise to these past lives? How do these rebirths actually come about? Is there any reason for these things? And how is it that one gets reborn now in a good state, now in a state of suffering? And at this point, he saw beings, various types of beings, dying and getting reborn. And through that seeing how beings died and got reborn, he was able to understand the law of kamma or karma, that we all pass on in accordance with our actions, with what we do or what we don't do. And this is the linkage that links us from life to life and life again, so on, almost forever backwards. And now is the interesting part, because at this point the Buddha had discovered two of what is known as the three true knowledges in Buddhism. He had discovered the fact of past lives. He had discovered how these past lives comes about. And now, at the very last thing for him to discover, the third of the last knowledge, is the knowledge of full enlightenment. It is very interesting to actually consider this for a second. Why is it that the Buddha actually recalled his past lives and understood the law of karma before he attained his full enlightenment? And this is another way of showing the importance of past lives in Buddhism. And the reason is very clear when you think about it. When you understand and when you see that you have been reborn again and again and again in the past, doing the same stupid things over and over again. Imagine that. It's terrible. Going through the same experiences life after life. Sometimes going through much worse experiences. Not going through really, really terrible experiences. A lot of times going through happy experiences. But generally just the tedium of doing this thing hundreds, maybe thousands, maybe millions of times suddenly becomes just unbearable, basically. And then when you understand the causal connection of karma, that basically you're not in charge, this all happens according to cause and condition, and you cannot really control what's happening here, it starts to become very frightening as well. Surely we don't want to just be at the kind of mercy of this law of karma, throwing us one day one way, another life another way, moving around in this thing called samsara, birth and death, without any clear direction whatsoever. It's frightening. And of course the Buddha saw this, he saw the danger in this. And it's only when he realized this that he was able to turn his mind towards enlightenment and towards the ending of this whole thing called birth and death. So birth and death, rebirth and death, is the cause which made it possible for the Buddha to attain enlightenment. Because only then, when he saw that, was he able to turn his mind away from samsara, rebirth and death, and towards enlightenment, towards nibbana, if you like. So from what I've said so far, you can see that rebirth is an extremely important part of the Buddha's teaching. It's not something you can just throw out and say, I can be a Buddhist without believing in rebirth. I can reject rebirth 100% as a stupid, non-scientific doctrine and still be a Buddhist. It doesn't quite work that way. You can still take on board some Buddhist principles, but if you throw away rebirth completely, you've thrown away such an important and essential part of Buddhism here, that it is you are, in a sense, in my opinion, a kind of partial Buddhist, not maybe 100% Buddhist. But I want to inquire a little bit further maybe on how important rebirth is in Buddhism. And the first thing I want to show is that because the Buddha actually realized rebirth, then rebirth for a Buddhist becomes a reality. It's something which actually is out there. It's not just a doctrine or an idea. It's a reality, just like gravity is a reality and the laws of physics are a reality. So rebirth is a reality. And because it is a reality, it means that There's something called a right view in Buddhism. Because it is a reality, if we are going to look at the world in the way the world actually is, then we are going to have to take on board the doctrine of rebirth. So right view in Buddhism, among other things, means to have some faith, some acceptance of the idea of rebirth. Without that acceptance, one does not really fulfill this thing called right view. So right view in Buddhism is nothing except the aligning of one's ideas, the straightening out of one's ideas in accordance with the reality of Buddhism, with the reality that the Buddha himself taught. That's all it really is. And this right view thing is actually very important. You may think, this might not be very obvious to you why right view is such an important matter. But right view is actually the very first factor on the Buddhist Eightfold Path. And of course, the Eightfold Path is the basic scheme in Buddhism for how one practices, how one starts off and practices all the way to full enlightenment. Right view is the beginning of that thing here. Because when you have right view, then it becomes natural that you want to practice a spiritual life. From that right view comes right intention. If you believe in rebirth, you will tend to want to live a moral life because you understand that not living a moral life is going to lead to suffering, particularly for yourself, but also for others, obviously. And moreover, you also get the intention that you want to get out of this whole idea of samsara, this whole idea of rebirth and death. You had enough of it. You want to get out of it. So for that reason, it leads to right intention. Right intention then moves over into right action. Because you have the intention to be kind, to be good, to be moral, and to end this whole cycle of rebirth, you start to act accordingly. You act with kindness, you speak with kindness, and you have a kind livelihood towards other beings. Once your moral life is established, then you want to straighten out your mind. You also want to have a moral mind. So you want to not to think thoughts which harm other beings. You don't want to have a defiled mind with all kinds of strange defilements in there. Instead, you want to have a mind of loving kindness, of compassion, of peace, of tranquility. This part is called right effort. Right effort is the overcoming of the defilements of the mind, making the mind pure, making the mind beautiful. Then, with that pure mind, you're able to practice meditation. Meditation is called right mindfulness in Buddhism, also known as satipatthana practice. Essentially, now you're starting to become very peaceful and have a very beautiful mind at this point. And that meditation then leads to these deep states called the jhanas, or samadhi states, if you like. So you can see here how important right view is. Right view is a foundation stone, which allows the entire practice, the entire Eightfold Path, to take off. Without that right view, your practice is going to be much, much weaker. If you have completely wrong view, you won't be practicing at all. So for this reason, again, rebirth is very important because it allows the path to happen. Now, once you have attained that deep samadhi, which is the end of the Eightfold Path, then that is when your mind is equipped. It's equipped to actually penetrate the truth itself, for you to become awakened, for you also to become enlightened, for you to understand the same reality as the Buddha understood. And what happens when you understand that reality? What happens when you see what the Buddha saw? And the interesting thing is that in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, it is always said that the first thing you say or you realize when you become an arahat, somebody who's fully awakened or enlightened, is that you understand that birth has been destroyed. There is no more coming to any kind of existence. This is my last birth. Now this you will see again and again and again in the discourses. It is a standard and a very common description of somebody who is fully enlightened. They understand that rebirth has come to an end. So the whole purpose of Buddhism, ultimately, there is of course many other purposes, many lesser purposes if you like, which also are very valuable and important. But the ultimate purpose of Buddhism is to end this whole thing called rebirth. This is what it's all about. This is what it all comes down to. So how can rebirth not be important if this is what the path is all about? In fact, it is fundamental. It is the core thing that we are seeking to overcome in this Buddhist practice. So it becomes like the all-important feature of the Buddhist path. So these are just some reflections on the importance of rebirth in Buddhism, to give you some background on how the Buddhism talks about these things. And I could go on for much more about this thing called rebirth, because it is everywhere to be found in the suttas. But I just wanted to bring out some of the more important statements of the Buddha about these things. And as you can see, it is essential in Buddhism. It is a very core part of the Buddhist practice. And for that reason, I will say again that it's impossible. You cannot really be 100% Buddhist if you reject rebirth out of hand completely. This is impossible. This cannot be the case. So how then do we gain, how do we come to accept this thing called rebirth? I mean, fair enough that the Buddha taught these things. How do we gain confidence that there actually is such a thing as rebirth? Because it's not very obvious just because the Buddha taught so. That does not necessarily mean that we ourselves should believe in this thing. Why should we believe in it just because the Buddha said so? And of course, the first thing is that if you know what the Buddha taught and you have a respect for the Buddha, you have respect for his teachings, and you know that his teachings work for yourself, then it becomes natural to take on also his other teachings. If you have taken on part of his morality, his meditation teachings, and you practice them for yourself, and you realize that they have made your life better, you have understood the wisdom of these teachings, then it becomes natural to at least, if you like, take on these ideas of rebirth as a hypothesis in your life, and use them in that sense. Because when you respect somebody, you will tend to also accept the way they teach things. And this is what it's all about, to go for refuge. In Buddhism, we talk about going for refuge to the triple gem, the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. And what this means, going for refuge, means that when we have some questions in our life, when we have some uncertainties about how to deal with the world, what to do, we have a place to go. We have a place where we can actually ask the questions, so to speak, from the Buddha by going to the suttas or by going to somebody who is the Buddha's representative, if you like, somebody you trust who knows those teachings. And we can ask the questions there, and we can find solutions to our problems in life. And that is what going to refuge means. It means that we have a place to go when there are difficulties, when there are problems, and when there is questions about spiritual practice. And because we take that refuge, it also means that we at least don't reject the idea of rebirth 100%. Because by rejecting it, we are not taking that refuge 100%, basically. That's the first way. Why and how we gain confidence in Buddhism. Another way we can get confidence in this idea of rebirth is by, at least for me, this is a very important way, is that sometimes you meet people who say, well, I've actually experienced these things for myself. I have seen this thing called rebirth. I know that there is such a thing as rebirth. When I meet somebody, particularly as a monk, occasionally you meet other monks who say these things. And very often these monks are people of incredible integrity, people of boundless kindness and goodness, people who it's very difficult to think that they would lie to you or they would say something, which is not the case. It becomes very hard to dismiss that thing out of hand when they say, I've seen it, it's there. There can be no doubt that these things exist. And for me, that it certainly becomes a very powerful reason to have confidence that there are such things. Of course, it's not an absolute confidence, but it certainly is a very good reason for believing in these things. So these are just some of the ways in which one gains confidence in these teachings. Another thing which is also is interesting, and I've just been reading a book quite recently called A Cross-Cultural Study of Karma and Rebirth. And it's fascinating how many places around the world that this idea of rebirth actually exists. And also the idea of karma actually exists. It's incredible how many places this is the case. And particularly this book talked about tribes, Indian tribes in North America, for example, which had ideas of karma and rebirth. Talks about people, many people in Africa, African indigenous cultures, have ideas of rebirth and karma. Tribes in Siberia, which have these ideas. Tribes in Melanesia, like Indonesia and some of the other Pacific islands. You find it spread out almost, you know, evenly around across the globe. You find that these ideas of rebirth actually exist. Very fascinating that it exists almost universally around the globe. And then you start to look at the different religions, and you find again that almost all the major religions have some sort of idea of rebirth in them. Obviously, Buddhism is one, Hinduism is one. But then you go to the more Western religions. Take Christianity for one, and it's very interesting that Christianity had an idea of rebirth for a long time in its early history. It was only at a certain council, I can't remember the details, but a council in year 400 or something like that, when it was decided that rebirth was not going to be an official doctrine of Christianity. But until that time, there were many people in the Christian church and many of the early gospels which actually taught rebirth. And you find the same thing in Islam. There are parts of Islam, even to this day, who believe in rebirth. You find the same thing in Judaism. So it's an incredibly universal thing, yeah. And also, very interesting is that if you ask people today, you take random interviews, for example, in Europe or even the United States, places which often are very atheistic, which don't actually have any religion at all, you actually find that very large percentages of the population believe in rebirth. 30-40% of the population believe in these things. Atheists believe in these things. Agnostics, Christians, Muslims, basically everybody. And this doesn't prove anything about rebirth, but it's very fascinating that if there is such a reality as rebirth, and it's possible to tap into that reality occasionally. Occasionally there will be people who maybe remember their past lives, or in some other way you tap into that reality, then you would expect that there would be large number of people around the globe, scattered everywhere, that had this belief, that actually understood this as a reality. That's what you would expect. And that is indeed also what you find. It's not a proof, but it certainly is, in my opinion, a supporting factor in this rebirth business. So that is the Buddhist side of things, and is also some of the reasons why I think it is perfectly good to have a strong confidence and a good confidence in rebirth. But I also want to talk a little bit about the negative side of this. What are the reasons we shouldn't believe in rebirth? Because I think it's important to be open about all these matters and not kind of lock ourselves away in a Buddhist kind of cocoon and pretend that everything is, that's all there is to it. There's, of course, much more to it than that. And the first thing that I want to just point out is that the Buddha, when he became enlightened, he actually discovered rebirth. He saw it for himself. And of course, once you see this thing for yourself, it becomes a knowledge. It becomes something which is undeniable. You cannot deny it anymore once you have seen it for yourself. But for most of us, the situation is very different. We haven't actually seen rebirth. We don't know that there is rebirth. We may have confidence. We may believe that the Buddha was very wise, very enlightened, and all these things. But because we haven't actually seen it for ourselves, we have reasons to at least acknowledge that we don't know. At least acknowledge that it is just a matter of confidence or faith at this stage. It's not something that we know already. So because we don't know it, there is good reasons not to go around proclaiming that this thing is a certain matter. And this shows us a difference, in my opinion, between belief and confidence and faith in the Buddhist religion and what is faith and belief in many other religions. And this is important because sometimes we take words like faith and belief, and these words are certainly very powerful in Christianity and also in Islam, as far as I know, and then we use them in Buddhism. But we have to be careful because sometimes when we do that, we also take Christian attitudes and Christian ideas or Muslim ideas or whatever it is into Buddhism. So we have to be careful not to, paint Buddhism with a Christian brush so as to put Christian ideas into Buddhist teaching. We have to be very clear about what Buddhism is all about in these cases. And the point I'm trying to make here is that in Christianity, faith and belief often are tantamount to certainty, as far as I understand. I'm not a specialist in this area. I could be wrong, but that is my impression. If you ask a Christian about, do you believe in God? He would obviously say yes. And then you ask him, well, does that mean that maybe God exists, maybe he doesn't exist? He will say, no, God definitely exists. That's my general understanding of how most Christians would reply here. So belief in many religions, faith in many religions, has this sense of certainty about it, that this is definitely true. Whereas in Buddhism, faith and belief have more of their original meaning. The original meaning of belief, of course, is that you believe something, it means maybe it's true, maybe it's not. You have faith in something, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. And that's why sometimes it's nice to call this confidence rather than faith or belief, because then we distinguish ourselves a little bit from the other religions. We don't cause so much confusion. If you're confident about something, it means maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. Have you got confidence that the bus will arrive in 5 minutes? Yes, I've got confidence it will arrive, but I'm not sure it will arrive. There's uncertainty there. And this is the attitude that we should have towards something like rebirth. We should have an attitude of confidence, but not firm and absolute faith and belief, simply because we don't know. We cannot be 100% sure, at least not at this stage. So this is the first thing to remember. The attitude towards rebirth should be something like confidence about it. Now the second thing I want to talk about, which I think is very important, and that is the scientific outlook on rebirth. I always feel uncomfortable if somebody calls me a anti-scientific Buddhist, who does not want to take into account scientific facts, who is maybe a kind of Luddite, who doesn't really, is not really up to scratch on what's happening in the modern world. I always find that unfortunate, and I think it's important. For me, one of the reasons that I've always felt very confident about Buddhism is precisely because I always felt that there wasn't so much conflict between science and Buddhism, as there was maybe between science and certain other faiths. That was why I felt this was the right thing for me. I felt that I didn't have to compromise any of my other principles so much. And for that reason, it is of course important to take into account what science says about this thing called rebirth. And very often when we read scientific journals, when we see what scientists say, very often they dismiss this idea of rebirth out of hand pretty much. And at this stage, we have to be careful, and we have to look at why is it that these scientists dismiss this thing called rebirth. And I have always found that when I have read journals and articles about the mind, about consciousness, usually the best people in the field of mind studies, of consciousness studies, they admit that they have no idea what these things actually are. They admit that the not understanding and the knowledge of this particular field is still in its infancy. People don't really understand consciousness. It's a very profound thing and very, very hard to get a grasp on. So that is the first thing to understand, that although science has a position on rebirth, it hasn't got an understanding of the mind, which is very sophisticated as yet. It's working on it, but it doesn't really understand the mind. And if you don't understand the mind, you cannot understand rebirth, because the precursor for believing in rebirth is that there can be such a thing as a mind which is separate from the material body. That the mind has, in a sense, a life of its own. It is not 100% dependent on the body for its existence. So for this, it's important to realize this. So when science often rejects rebirth, in my opinion, as far as I can see, it's often without having the firm evidence which is required for rejecting it. So why is it then that science rejects rebirth? And I think that the thing of rebirth is often considered a religious thing in scientific circles, And because science and religion has often been at loggerheads over many centuries, and science has been saying one thing, religion something else, science has tended to dismiss religious beliefs as just beliefs, and for that reason hasn't really taken them seriously. But, of course, just because something is a religious belief does not mean that it's wrong. And in this particular case, it is my conviction that science just hasn't yet arrived at a point where it can take a meaningful position on this thing called rebirth. So, and I also remember that what I find very fascinating about science, I remember when I was in, I can't remember whether it was high school or at university or what it was, I remember reading about scientific revolutions. And I remember in very particular, I remember reading about this English physicist called Martin Rutherford, I think his name was. And I remember he was saying, this was towards the end of the 19th century, and this was at the time when physics was advancing very, very fast, and they were describing the atomic models with protons and neutrons and all this sort of stuff. And he said that, well, everything is now coming together so beautiful in physics. The periodic table has been sorted out. We understand how all these atoms are made up. We understand how molecules are made up. And it's only a matter of a few years now before everything is sorted out, before we have full understanding of physics. And then, of course, a few years after he said that, came Albert Einstein along with the theory of relativity. And then soon after that, you got this idea of quantum mechanics. And this turned physics completely upside down. And I think today they are just as far away from finding the final solution to these things as they were at the time of this Martin Rutherford 120 years ago. And this is because science goes through revolutions every now and again. And maybe one day, I think it's quite possible, that science will go through the revolution where it will realize that actually there is such a thing as a mind which is apart and can be apart from materiality. At the moment, science cannot see that, but I think it's quite possible that this will change over the years. Maybe it won't, maybe it will, but I certainly think it is possible. So that is the scientific, in a sense, rejection of rebirth, most generally speaking. But it's also very fascinating to understand and to realize that there are some very interesting signs going on in the area of rebirth. And this is what I want to talk about next. This is the scientific, in a sense, evidence for rebirth. And the most interesting of this scientific evidence is a man who died only a few months ago, a man called Ian Stevenson, who used to teach at the University of Virginia in the United States. It's quite a prestigious university in the U.S., actually. And he taught there, and he studied what he called past life memories in children. And he studied this over several decades. And this is some of the best scientific evidence which is available for rebirth. And it has made quite an impact in many ways, in the scientific world, although, of course, it's not been accepted. And what he did, he traveled around the world because there is a phenomenon everywhere around the world whereby small children tend to recall past lives. They tend to say something, sometimes they go up to their mother and say to their mother, "You're not my mother. My mother lives over there." And very often the mother gets very upset. And of course I'm your mother. I know more about that than you do. So you shouldn't be so sure about that. But often the child is very insistent that it has some memory of something else. That he lived somewhere else before. And he would point to a house, point to a village, talk about people which the parents have never heard about. And this is a global phenomenon, according to this Dr. Ian Stevenson. He did research in the United States, in Europe, in large parts of Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East. And everywhere he found these children who remembered past lives. And of course, I'm sure you can imagine what his methodology was. His methodology was to ask these children in great detail about those memories, and then check out whether that village, that house that they were talking about, those people that they mentioned, those names that the children were talking about, do they actually exist? Are there such places? And he came up with some extraordinarily fascinating results. And some of those cases he had were just not explainable in any scientific way, apart from assuming that there must be something called rebirth, some reason why these children actually could remember these things. Very, very powerful evidence as far as I can see, and very difficult to refute. And I have not heard of anybody who has really successfully refuted this evidence. Some of the other things that he showed, for example, also spoke to certain children had birthmarks in particular places. And these were children had remember dying, for example, a very painful death, for example, through being shot. And of course, because they were shot, that birthmark they had corresponded to the place they were shot. And then by investigating whether such a person existed who was shot, he would often find that that particular person that this child remembered did exist. And they died in exactly that way. And the child had the corresponding birthmark in this life. Again, it's very, very, very powerful in my opinion. And it's very hard to really understand how such a causal connection could happen unless it is through some sort of mechanism like the idea of rebirth. But of course, just because there is evidence or one person has come up with a lot of evidence does not mean that the scientific community is going to jump onto that and say, yes, this must be true. It takes much more than that. I just want to show that there is some evidence out there. So the scientific community is, if you like, at least slightly split. There is something also on the side of rebirth. So what then should our attitude be here? How should we then look at rebirth? There is the negative side that science doesn't believe in rebirth, and we have to take that seriously. We cannot, as modern people, reject the scientific viewpoint of things. That would be silly to do. Science and Buddhism should, in my opinion, go together as far as possible, unless science itself oversteps the bounds. And if there are certain doctrines in Buddhism which turn out to be wrong, well, okay, then maybe we have to accept that certain things are actually wrong. And maybe these are things which weren't taught by the Buddha in the first place anyway. The other side of the story is that the Buddha did teach rebirth. And because people who are Buddhist and have faith in this thing have to take what the Buddha said extremely seriously, we cannot reject rebirth outright either. So the way to look at rebirth is to take a kind of middle way, the famous middle way in Buddhism, neither to reject it outright, nor to go around proclaiming it as an absolute truth. But somewhere in the middle there is where people who are Buddhist should find themselves. So if you find that you are somewhere in the middle there, then that is a very good starting point for being a Buddhist. So whether you have 90% confidence that there is rebirth, or maybe you only have 20 or 30% confidence, you are somewhere on the scale, and you can definitely, on that basis, I would say, count yourself as a Buddhist. I have a very strong conviction that there is such a thing as rebirth, but at the same time, I'm also open to the possibility that there isn't rebirth. I haven't seen rebirth for myself. This is the truth. And because of that, I'm open to the possibility that there isn't rebirth. And I have asked myself the question, what will happen if science one day came up with evidence that was so powerful, so strong against rebirth, that I couldn't reject it, that I had to accept it? What would I do myself, being a Buddhist monk? And the truth is, I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's extremely unlikely, but I'm certainly open to the possibility. But if that were to happen, I realize I would have to disrobe, or at least very likely I would have to disrobe, because the Buddhist path, and particularly the monastic path, is so completely intertwined and so completely mixed up with this idea of rebirth. Take it away, and essentially it loses its meaning. So that is my position on that. And it is not as if I'm about to disrobe anything. Because I have very strong confidence in this thing called rebirth. And I think it's extremely unlikely that science is going to show it to be untrue. I think rather the contrary is much more likely, that science itself is going to come around and slowly go through a revolution whereby it starts to understand that there is more to the scientific worldview than is presently acknowledged. So that is just a talk on rebirth for you here. Okay, so if you have any questions or any ideas of your own or anything you want to discuss, this is a good time to bring it up. Any particular issues that you want to talk about concerning rebirth or anything else maybe? Okay, that's very easy. Nobody has any questions? Usually it's a controversial topic. Usually it's something people want to have to say about, but are you all convinced there is rebirth? Yes? Well, that's a very good point. And of course, according to Buddhism, of course, that's the case. If you don't believe in rebirth, it doesn't really help you at all. All it means that you have wrong view, and you're going to act maybe against the Buddha's teachings. You're going to do all kinds of stupid things. And then you end having a bad rebirth on top of having a rebirth at all. So it's bad news. Yes, it doesn't matter what you believe. It's because it's a reality. It's like the laws of physics. Whether you believe in the laws of physics or not, they're still going to affect you. If you jump, you're going to come down again, right? Gravity. It's the same thing with rebirth. It's a reality. No? Yeah. Good. Okay. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, I think the main thing about Buddhism is that it's a teaching which doesn't talk about any particular beginning. It doesn't actually have a beginning as such. So it's not as, it actually goes on. If you start looking into past lives, it goes on forever, basically. And the Buddhism actually talks about universal contraction and universal expansions, which are a bit like the Big Bang. And then you have like the big crunch after the Big Bang, and then a Big Bang again after that, one after the other. And this is essentially the Buddhist cosmology. The Buddhism doesn't really have all that much to say about evolution on Earth as such. There are certain creation suttas or discourses that were possibly taught by the Buddha, but it's difficult to know whether these are mythological or whether they actually describe a real, a reality. I don't really want to get maybe too much into that. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't see any contradiction between the ideas of evolution, which is basically essentially creatures coming out of the sea, become on land. I don't see any essential contradiction between evolution and Buddhism. As far as I'm concerned, they're compatible theories. Right. Yeah. Sure. I think that's a good point. But there's always a problem of interpretation, you see, because the suttas were taught 2,500 years ago. When the Buddha talks about expansion and contraction of the world, that's what basically, if you want to translate it literally, that's what it means. It's not exactly clear what it means. Does it mean a Big Bang or does it mean something else? It's hard. It's very convenient to think it's a Big Bang because it fits with modern theories. But it's very hard to actually be absolutely sure that's what it's all about. So there's always going to be some uncertainty there. And because of, but personally, I think there's a very good grounds for believing. He was talking about precisely that. So yes, and I agree with you. And this is exactly what I was talking about before. You start reading the suttas of the Buddha, his discourses. You start getting understanding of what he taught. And you find that actually there's so much wisdom there. There's so many beautiful teachings. And you can't just throw it out of the window, There's something you can lead your life by, and you find that you actually gain in happiness, you gain in peace, you gain in all these beautiful things that you want. So something is working there, something is right. Then, of course, precisely as you say, you gain in confidence in these teachings. And even those things you don't know for yourself, you're no longer willing to just throw them out and call them rubbish because you realize there's something beautiful going on here. Yes, sir. Okay, this is actually a very important question. And this is something I thought maybe I would touch on tonight, but you can, sometimes you can just touch on too many topics and you sort of lose completely the thread of the discussion. But according to Buddhism, and this is a very profound teaching of Buddhism, that there isn't actually anything being reborn again. And this is what is so strange in a sense, because most other ideas of rebirth around the world have an idea of a soul or some kind of permanent entity inside of us, which goes from birth to birth. In Buddhism, what essentially gets reborn again is the mind. The mind moves on from one life to another. But the mind in Buddhism is not like the soul in any other religion. It's not a permanent entity in its own right. It's an ever-changing reality, the mind. So it is this ever-changing reality called the mind which gets reborn from one life to another. So, and this is a very profound teaching. And this is what we call a non-self in Buddhism. This idea of anatta is it's called in the Pali language, ancient Buddhist language. And it's a non-self idea. And it's a bit like, sometimes it's explained a bit like a candle. If you have a candle, for example, and you light one candle with another candle, well, did anything go across from one candle to another one? And the answer is, nothing really went across, but somehow the flame was transferred from one to the other one. And in a similar way, you can maybe picture rebirth. It is a continuity. There is a mind which continues, but it's not. There's nothing permanent there which goes on. Make sense? Kind of, yeah? Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, it does, because the thing about Buddhism is that you don't just believe in the human realm. You believe in beings in many realms, particularly animal realm. So rebirth is much more than just being reborn as a human being. It's also being reborn as an animal. And in fact, according to Buddhism, you can be reborn in all kinds of different states. And because there are so many possibilities, human beings can come from all these various realms and then get reborn as humans. And then when you die, you can either become a human being again, or you can be reborn as something else. All according to your karma, all according to your actions. So depending how you live this life. If you live a good life, generally speaking, you get a good rebirth. If you live a bad life, generally speaking, you get a bad rebirth. Yes? I think there's a lot to be said for that idea, actually. And I know that those people who really know the discourses of the Buddha very well, there actually is a lot of evidence in those discourses that there is such an in-between state. In a sense, you die, the mind goes off to this in-between state, and it takes a while before your karma, your actions from the past life, actually ripen and then give effect to a particular rebirth. And this is actually is a very controversial topic, because according to the Orthodox Theravada point of view, there is no in-between state. And yet, when you look at what the Buddha taught, it seems to be very clearly implied in his teaching that there is such a thing. So I am certainly in favor of the existence of an in-between state. So you can continue celebrating Halloween and having good fun. So. Okay. So let's just pay respects to the... Okay, one more question here. Yeah. Essentially, yes. Because the whole point here is that there's a continuity, right? If you think about how you are in this life, there's basically continuity here. You know, who you are today is pretty much who you were yesterday. There's a continuity there. And because it is the mind which continues from one life to the next, it's a similar kind of continuity across lives as we find within this life. And that is precisely why it is so important to develop the mind, to be a good person. Because by developing the mind, by being a good person, you are in a sense lifting up the mind. You're making the mind beautiful and purer, and then you will carry that beautiful and pure mind into the next life. That's how it works. And that is why a beautiful and pure mind will get reborn in a beautiful and pure place. It's like magnetic attraction almost. That's the way it works. So yes, you tend to take things with you the way you are in this life. Your character traits carry on from life to life usually. It's a good reason to practice.